Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we heard about the very real and very significant impact that extremely cold temperatures can have on human beings. But the cold has an impact on man-made structures, too. Buildings, bridges, and ships on Lake Michigan all face perils when it comes to temperatures as low as the ones we're experiencing this week. Charles Ryerson has studied how cold and ice affect superstructures. He's with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory in Hanover, New Hampshire, and he joins us on the line. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate it.
What are the key reasons that you study cold and ice? Why is this a subject of scientific interest?
Well, of course, the polar regions are almost continuously cold. You heard on the news about the research ship this last week that was frozen in the ice in the Antarctic. But, of course, the majority of us on the planet in the mid-latitudes and farther poleward experience winter. And winter, we all live with and tolerate, but it has its costs and its hazards and its use of energy and its effect on human health and an effect on the economics of how we do things. And so it has a very high cost, and as I say, we tolerate it because it's something we have to live with. And surprisingly, there's not more done with it than is research-wise than there is, frankly.
Well, and so we hear a lot about engineering in, say, hurricane or earthquake-prone areas. But let's talk about the particular engineering challenges in a place like Milwaukee or another northern kind of city in which there's a frequent freeze-thaw cycle, and it can get down to 10 below or 20 below or even colder than that. What are the engineering challenges to structures like buildings or bridges or other large man-made objects?
Well, initially, of course, the foundations have to be built to withstand soil freeze-thaw on heaving of the soil and migration of moisture, which forms frost lenses, which those of you in the northern latitudes, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, we had this problem. Potholes forming in roads where water migrates up because of the freezing and forms a lens, and then, of course, it expands and breaks the pavement away. So the first thing you have to deal with is a foundation. And then, of course, once the structure is built, hopefully on an appropriate foundation, then you have problems of icing and snow formation on power lines, for example, on tall towers, tall buildings. For example, the new 1776 tower that was built in New York had quite a bit of There was quite a bit of concern about ice formation on that structure and it falling to the pavement and being a hazard to people. So structures accumulate ice, for example, from either freezing rain or snow from rime ice or sometimes even from snow that you'll get freeze-thaw cycles, as you mentioned earlier, and water will run down into a crotch, let's say, where two structural members come together. It'll form a chunk of ice that may be the size of a baseball. And if that falls then 500 feet to the ground and it weighs a pound or two, it can be lethal, actually.
Is there anything that you can do to engineer a building or a bridge to keep that ice from forming or to mitigate how it falls?
Actually, design can be a fairly significant way to deal with ice, but it all depends on the kind of ice that's going to form. If you have ice that forms from freezing rain or snow, it's pretty difficult because freezing rain or snow will land on and stick to just about anything. If you have in-cloud icing, so let's say you have a fog that forms and you have tiny cloud droplets that are 20 microns in diameter, then airflow causes them to either strike an object and freeze and cause ice to grow into the wind, or the droplets will pass around it. And as it, this seems counterintuitive, but larger diameter objects ice less than smaller diameter objects because water droplets in clouds or fog will tend to flow around larger diameter objects, but they'll tend to collide with smaller diameter objects and freeze.
Huh. So we've heard about these ships in the Antarctic region trapped in the ice, which is obviously a consistent problem in that part of the world. But how do bodies of water like the Great Lakes ice up in comparison to sea ice? And what are the unique problems that icing on the Great Lakes might cause to ships and other structures on the lake?
Well, any, we'll call it a seagoing vehicle or a vehicle that's out in the ocean. So now we're talking about offshore platforms in the oil industry or ships will ice if spray is created either by waves or by, in the case of a ship, its bow plunging into the seas. So in the ocean, we have salt water, and the typical salinity of salt water is about 33 parts per thousand, fairly high. High enough that the freezing point is depressed by a couple of degrees Fahrenheit. And when the water lands on the vessel, in particular, the large amounts of water to land on a ship, the water will freeze. But water doesn't freeze with salt in it. So what happens is that the water freezes, it excludes the salt and causes it to be concentrated in what we call brine pockets. And those brine pockets weaken the ice.
But this is why people, you know, use salt to break up ice on the roads, for example.
That's right. But in the Great Lakes, we have fresh water. And freshwater ice freezes, of course, at 32 Fahrenheit. And it doesn't have salt in it. And as a result, it forms clear ice. And it's much harder and much more tenacious in the sense that its adhesion strength to substrates, to decks, to railings, to whatever on a ship, is much, much stronger. So when the Coast Guard goes out with their small icebreakers and tries to either do search and rescue or create passages for ships, they experience superstructure icing. Now, they don't experience it when they're breaking ice. The floating ice suppresses the waves and you don't get any spray. But if they're in transit, let's say between Sheboygan, across Lake Michigan, when they're in the open lake, the spray will form on the ship. The bow, the bow generates spray, then that passes up over the ship. And it can be sufficient to cause so much weight and such an increase in the height of the center of gravity of the ship that it'll founder, it'll roll over and sink. Fortunately, we haven't lost a Coast Guard cutter that way. I don't think since the Second World War, and that was in the Atlantic. But fishing trawlers are lost every year. I don't know what the current statistics are, but those that watch reality television have seen crabbing boats certainly ice up, and the technology we use to de-ice them today is what we've used for the last several hundred years probably, and that's mallets and things like baseball bats.
Well, and so this brings us back to our initial question about the key reasons you study cold and ice. Is this an issue that people are taking on, better ways to de-ice a freshwater ship?
To de-ice any ship, freshwater or saltwater, is a significant problem. And right now it's being looked at pretty carefully because the Arctic Ocean is opening up. And as the Arctic Ocean opens up, there'll probably be more activity up there, commercial activity, tour boats, maybe military activity, we don't know. As a result, the Coast Guard is going to have a much more active presence, at least off the north coast of Alaska. And they'll be pushing the envelope in the sense of the edges of the season. In the late fall, early winter are the most dangerous times up there for superstructure icing, as we call it. And so the goal is to try to develop better ways to either prevent icing on ships and offshore platforms or to remove it without having to send people out on deck with baseball bats or whatever and to break it off, because now you have people out in the elements on a rolling ship on a icy deck swinging mallets, and it's a pretty serious thing to have to ask people to do in those conditions. The problem with icing is that most of the times it doesn't sink ships, but it is a safety hazard to the ship because the anchoring hardware is frozen in, navigation aids are frozen in, sometimes the radars become frozen, antennas ice over and they can't communicate effectively. And so most of the time it's a hazard, we'll call it a safety hazard, rather than a threat to life, but it can easily become a threat to life.
As someone who studies cold weather and icing for a living, does a cold snap like the one that's happening across the northern half of the U.S., do you look at it in the sense of, well, this is going to provide me more data in the future?
The tragic part of our discipline is that when serious conditions happen and power lines fall and ships sink and airplanes crash, then there's interest in the renewed interest in the problem, and there's renewed interest in trying to solve those problems. So, no, we do not wish these things to happen. And but unfortunately, tragedy does happen, and so we tend to be a society that responds to problems after they've happened, and so that's how the research happens. It would be wonderful to be able to go out and collect data every time these storms occur, and occasionally we can do that, but the resources aren't typically available to take advantage of that.
Well, Charles Ryerson, thanks so much for helping shed some light on this issue for us.
Thank you very much, Mitch. Nice to talk to you.
Charles Ryerson is with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory in Hanover, New Hampshire, where we reached him by phone.